danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 306 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Melrose, Massachusetts is Andrew Brokus. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. I'm a little sad I'm going to be leaving Melrose, Massachusetts soon, but it's been great. Well, it's been great getting to meet your family, and it's been great getting to play at the Encore, and I appreciate you inviting me to stay here with you.
It's been a pleasure having you. And you hit good weather, too.
It's a it's been beautiful.
Nice late summer, early fall in Melrose. Great time to walk, great time to relax, great time to play some cards.
Yeah, and well, it's also been nice. We got to have breakfast this morning with John the lawyer. I thought about trying to get him to come record with us, but you know, he's just in Boston really to play at the Encore, and he's got a family of his own, and I know it's sort of a sacrifice for him to come up here to play, and he might have even agreed if we had asked him, but I felt kind of guilty even asking him because I know these are pretty high value hours for him. So sorry to podcast listeners, we kept John selfishly just for ourselves this morning.
Yeah, and John was, as always, he was great, and I consider him a sort of executive producer of this show. he always has a list of things he wants to discuss, and here's one of them. This time he's very involved procedurally and almost administratively at the Encore. He has a good relationship with people there. He knows the rules. He's been involved, I guess, in even creating some of the rules.
I would guess he's a bit like a mayor of the mixed game.
Yeah, exactly. And he handed me a printout of some of the rules from the Encore, which include something about Mambo Stud Poker. I've never heard of Mambo Stud Poker. Andrew's never heard of Mambo Stud Poker. John the lawyer has never heard of Mambo Stud Poker. So, dear listeners, if you know what the hell Mambo Stud Poker is, please let me know. I'll tell you, there's a whole card that's down, then you each get some cards that are up, and then there's a community card at the end. And that format roughly rings a bell to me, but I did not know it under that name. So if anybody out there knows something about the history or practice or world of Mambo Stud Poker, podcast@thinkingpoker.net, please tell us.
I wonder, I mean, I guess it could just be five-card stud where the last card is a community card.
It could be. I mean, that's literally what it is. I mean, I got the rules in front of me. I've read them.
I didn't know if we knew it was five cards.
Is that
confirmed?
It goes down up. So there are two rounds.
Okay.
In each of the first two rounds, you get a card down and a card up.
Oh, wait, so it goes down up bet.
Yeah, down up bet.
And then a final community card.
Mambo! I joke, but this sounds pretty great, yeah. And I want to play.
No, I mean, apparently they're prepared to spread it at the Encore. I feel like we need to get a Mambo Stud game going.
Yeah, that'd be great. Anybody who wants to play 3-6 Mambo Stud, that would be fantastic. It sounds... Wait, there are only three betting rounds? It's, first round of betting.
Maybe there's three rounds of up, down, up, down, up, down.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. So the first round is up, down. So, okay. And then after the first betting round, then you get a face down card. Okay, good. Wait, this is really complicated. Okay, this is not a good live casting thing. It's weirder than I said before, but I definitely want to play. Come play some 3-6 Mambo with me. And if you know what's going on.
Next time I'm out here, we need to organize a meetup. And I think it just needs to be built around Mambo Stud.
Yeah.
It's going to be a Mambo Stud meetup.
Yes.
So the other thing we were talking about to John about, and actually I'm hopeful John has put me in touch with, I guess he's the card room director at the Encore. You know, there are various people who need to approve this kind of thing, but he seemed open to coming on the show. So I'm hopeful that we'll get a chance to talk to the man behind some of these policies. But we were talking to John. There's some pretty interesting policies that they've put in place at the Encore that are a part of why I respect them for this. I mean, in general, I like people who are kind of like trying to innovate and do, like, I think there's room for some improvement procedurally and some things that happen in the poker world, and I appreciate anyone who's kind of trying to innovate on that. But in particular, I appreciate these innovations because I think they're good for the game, but I think that the sort of thing that, because they're new, because a lot of people may not appreciate why they exist, I think they're probably going to be unpopular and, like, lead to the Encore, at least in the beginning, like, taking it on the chin a lot from people who are sort of, like, complaining about these rules without really appreciating them. But I think they're good policies. So the first of these is, you know, a typical must move game. I imagine a lot of people know what this is, but, you know, if you wanted to play, you know, 5-10, for instance, and there's one 5-10 game going, and then they start a second 5-10 game, typically what they're going to do is they're going to make that second game a must move, which means that anytime that a seat opens up in the main game, they take a player off of the must move in the order in which those players join the must move game, and then those players are, they must move into the main game. What's a little bit different at Encore is they'll keep, I think what they typically do is they'll keep eight players in the main game rather than keeping the main game totally full in an interest, in hopes of keeping the must move game robust as well, rather than drawing the must move game down to say three or four handed in order to keep the main game full. Like they won't prioritize filling the main game at all costs. They'll try to keep the must move game viable as well, which strikes me, like, I've always kind of wondered why this didn't happen. I mean, I know why it doesn't happen, but it seemed to me that, like, something that should happen, and I was a little surprised that nowhere else did this. So personally, I like seeing this at the Encore, but I'm curious how you feel about it, Nate.
I think it's good. I think people will complain, but I also think it's the sort of thing people can get used to, and yeah, I'm all for it. I think it's, you know, the difference between playing seven-handed and playing nine-handed is not as big as the difference between playing five-handed and playing seven-handed. As it happens, I would love to play five-handed against live players, so you get the rank break, but, like, a lot of people don't like that, and it'll just cause the game not to go. And, you know, getting two viable games when you would have gotten one is, I think, good. And I'm aware there are downsides, too, but as far as I can tell, the balance is definitely positive, and I applaud the Encore for innovation in this regard.
Yeah, I think it's the sort of thing where, you know, people who are in the main game, who are used to having the main game filled, and they want to play a full game, you know, they're just going to be upset because they're like, oh, this isn't how any other card room does it, and I want a player in that seat, and you're not moving one over here, and I feel entitled to it, and I'm upset about it. I feel like those same players, when they're in a must-move game that's, like, seven-handed, and they're not having someone must-moved into the main game, they're going to appreciate it in that case. But they're not going to be equally vocal in sharing their appreciation.
Yeah. And, like, also, you say they'll be upset, but I think mostly they'll just complain. Like,
yeah, right. They're not going to, like, take their money elsewhere.
And, like, how often does it happen where you're in a nine-handed game and two people are in the bathroom? It's, like, not that uncommon. Like, right. People are basically, like, they might prefer a full game, but people are perfectly accustomed to playing seven-handed for stretches.
But then, I mean, it's also possible that the game is only eight-handed because they're not must-moving someone, and then two people go to the bathroom, and now you're playing six-handed.
Yeah, but, like, they'll deal.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
Especially,
I should say they'll complain, not that they're
going to. Yeah, it's like, it's going to be, I think it's going to be fine. I think it's going to be fine.
I once saw, I think this is the very first time I ever played at Lucky Chances. They used to run their 2-5 10-handed. So I was in the 2-5 game, and someone said to the floor, like, we've got an open seat. And but he was like, rogue. He's like, open seat. There's an open seat. Seat's been open for 10 minutes. Come on, let's fill it. You know, he was pretty aggressive complaining about it. And then the floor was like, oh, actually, you've got two open seats. And he's like, what? We're 10-handed. 10, come on. It had to be 9. 9 was the right number.
Yeah. Like, Oh, that's good. Yeah, it's amazing. People really, a lot of people, these people are playing in a way that, like, you know, it's not going to make any difference to them. Yeah.
So that's one. The other one that I like, this one's a little bit more complicated, and maybe I'm not even sure if they do this in the smaller games. I think it's less of a big deal in the smaller games. But what happens when, so at least like in the 5-10, they lock seats that are open. In other words, when you join a game, or when the game starts, you pick a seat, and if the game is starting short, everyone chooses their seats, and then the other seats are locked. So you can't just decide anytime you feel like it, oh, I'm going to move into that other seat. And then once the game is full, when someone quits, the dealer is supposed to say to the table, so now there's 8 players and 9 seats. The dealer is supposed to say to the table, would anyone like to move into that open seat? And you have priority on moving based on how long you've been in the game. And you do this before you get information about who the next player on the list is or who's coming over to the game. So you don't yet know who's going to be in that seat. And then once we determine whatever the open seat is going to be, so if someone takes that seat, then their seat is open, and we repeat that process with anyone like this seat that has now become available. Once there's an open seat that no one currently in the game wants, then they fill that seat. And once you see a player walking over into that seat, you can't have the musical chairs where people are like, oh no, I'm going to take that seat. And then they take his seat, and that player stands there for 3 minutes while 6 people seat change. And there's a few problems with this. One is it's just annoying and it slows the game down. The bigger problem is it looks very bad, and in fact is very bad, if that player is sort of like action player or whatever you want to call it. It's just like, it's insulting to that person that everyone is kind of like jostling to get position on them. It's arguably even kind of unfair to them or like extra predatory or whatever. And I think just fundamentally it's a collective action problem. Like, it's not good for the game to have this sort of thing happen, but when it's allowed to happen, it is kind of like plus EV for the individual who jumps into that open seat. So it's just like, it's an opportunity for someone to gain like personal, to get like a personal EV gain at the expense of kind of what's good for the overall health of the game. And so I think it's good that they've put into place a structure that prevents that kind of aggressive seat changing.
Yep.
Now, the problem with this, in my experience, is that neither a lot of the floor and a lot of the dealers are either like not fully aware of this policy or have decided that they don't really. So I mean, this is an even more controversial one than the must move thing. Like, people really don't like when they want to be allowed to, like, because they're so used to being able to change seats. Like, they see an open seat, no one's sitting there, like, oh, I would like to take that seat. Yeah. And they get, like, I've seen people get pretty upset when they're told that they can't take that seat. And it's often, in fact, shout out to Russian Andrew, it's often been players who are the ones really putting their foot down on this, which I respect. I think a lot of the dealers have not felt that it was really in their, like, it just wasn't worth the hassle to them of enforcing this rule, and so I've seen them allowing players to switch, and I think in some cases the dealers just also don't really know what's going on. So I think like there's kind of a need. I think if they hold the line on this for a little while and people get used to it, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But right now it's a little bit of a mess in terms of like not consistently enforcing this.
Yep, I agree with everything you said. The only thing is, if you like I do work in software, this is exactly the sort of thing that should be like done by software. And it's like seeing humans try to like, it's like just do this like sort of extremely algorithmic kind of thing. And not just humans, but poker players try to it's a little bit tilting. But yeah, no, good rule. Good rule. The only thing about seat changing that I think doesn't work great at the Encore is that you don't lose your priority when you take a seat. Yeah. So they always have a clock on you when you're playing. And this is useful for a bunch of things. For example, they will comp your parking if you are there at least 3 hours. But you always get higher priority if you've been playing longer. And that's that. You don't lose your priority when you take the seat. So whoever is the senior member of the table always gets first crack at a seat. In practice, this hasn't come up very often in my games, but in theory, it seems, bad. But it also, like, whatever. Not that big a deal, I don't think. But it's an imperfection, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other cost here is there are people who like to change seats for non-strategic reasons.
Oh, they're extremely strategic. They're just based on funny metaphysics.
Yeah, okay, so it's not based on who's coming into the seat.
No,
right.
No, no.
So it's just like, oh, I feel like my seat is unlucky. You know, you get stacked in your current seat. And you're like, oh, this seat is unlucky. I need to change seats or whatever. You know, like, so those people are not, like, that's actually not doing any damage to the game if people want to change seats for that reason. And, you know, those people are not accommodated by this rule. And, like,
it's sort of like if the Patriots are about to come on and somebody just wants to see, get, like, a better angle on the game, like, a lot of those people, you definitely want to stay in the game and be distracted.
Right. Yeah, that's probably a better example, because mine is, like, I know that's not a very sympathetic case. Like, we kind of roll our eyes and laugh at those people. But, like, ultimately, like, it's their interest. Yeah, sure. Like, they're in the game. Like, they're allowed, I mean, or in games where they're allowed to change seats. Like, it's a thing that they, like, it's part of their entertainment or whatever. Is, you know, they enjoy doing that. They're going to enjoy the game more if they're allowed to do that. And, you know, I think ideally we accommodate that. I don't know if there's a way to do that. Probably not within this rule. I think that might just be a, you know, unfortunate collateral damage. But I guess that's, like, one of the downsides is there are sometimes, you know, people who want to change seats for reasons that don't have to do with getting a position on a particular player. And there you get hurt a little bit by this.
Yep.
But yeah, overall, I think it's, like, I mean, especially for being such a young room, I think it's already quite well run. I mean, even just in like the 2 weeks that I've been playing there, it feels like it's going better now than it was the first time that I went there. They've got some, I mean, there's a clear difference in terms of the experience level of various dealers. Like, there's some that I know from Maryland Live who have come up here to deal, and I'm sure they're getting experienced dealers from elsewhere as well. And then they also have some people where, you know, they've clearly, like, this is their first dealing job and they're still sort of learning a little bit. But those are all, like, kinks that are going to get worked out. I had a cashier last night who was extremely slow, but he was at least, like, friendly about it. I mean, that's all just, like, growing pains.
Yep. No, I'm impressed with the room. It's better than I thought it would be, and it's cool. It's a good Vegas style card room close to my house. It's crazy. It just, you know, the gambling came to me. It's yeah. I think it's about time to talk some strategy. Whom or what do we have to thank for this strategy segment?
Surprisingly, today the strategy segment is brought to us by Tournament Poker Edge. And I guess I said last week, it's always the best time to join Tournament Poker Edge because there's new content constantly being added and they're not getting rid of any of the old content. So it's always getting better. But I would say now is a particularly exciting moment because my series looking at all of the pots that I played and some of the pots even that I did not play in the 2019 World Series of Poker main event. I've got a huge blockbuster of a series, something like, you know, 12 parts, over 6 hours of content is going up on there. And that's really just walking through just a lot of, I mean, some of the mundane spots as well, but a lot of interesting spots. I think there are a lot of interesting things that came up, a lot of things that reflect sort of, for at least for me, the kind of, like, bleeding edge of how I'm thinking about poker. Some things, like hands that I would have played differently a year or even 6 months ago compared to how I played them now. So I think it's one of the most exciting series that I've done, and that is available exclusively at tournamentpokeredge.com. First strategy hand today is coming to us.
Wait. We got one more thing to plug. Oh. By the time you hear this, hopefully, or maybe soon, at some point, Weekend Warrior. It's a set of premium podcasts. Andrew and I have made them. It is targeted toward, it should be useful for anyone. But it is the formal audience of this is people who get a chance to play sometimes, are serious, want to play their best on the weekend. You know, the title tells you a lot about this. So if you are a weekend player or if you have any features in common with the weekend poker player who wants to play well but, you know, cannot spend 50 hours a week on poker or poker-related things, this is for you. I'm excited about it. Andrew is excited about it. We both agree it's some of the best stuff we've made, and we're very excited to be able to offer it now or soon. Weekend Warrior, nickcast.com.
So this hand is coming to us from Benito. He played this in a 1-2 no limit game. He said the max buy-in is $200, although sick brag, hero has $750. The main villain has $300, so $300 is going to be our effective stack here. Kira is in the big blind with King 5 offsuit. There's four limpers, and Hiro checks his option. I think so far so good. I don't really see a reason to either raise or open fold with this hand. So
yeah, it's a yep.
But I mean, we're happy enough to get a free flop. Good things can happen. After the rake, there is $8 in the pot, and the flop is Ace of Spades, King of Hearts, Ten of Spades. Our hero is holding King of Diamonds, Five of Spades. So two spades on the board, five of spades in the hero's hand, for whatever that's worth. Ace, King, Ten, two-tone. The small blind checks. Our hero checks. It checks all the way around to the button. Button bets $10 into the $8 pot. Small blind folds, and we're back on hero, who again is holding King, Five on Ace, King, Ten. You calling this bet?
I would fold every time. I would fold every time. It's a multi-way pot. It's pretty easy for someone to have an ace, and especially, you know, as I think a lot of players have known for a long time, but was first made really vivid to me in one of those really old David Sklansky books. You know, if you're up against players who play too many aces, then it really changes your strategy after the flop. When an ace hits, it's pretty easy to have an ace. It's not impossible to have a straight, even a flush draw you're not far ahead of. This could look like somebody trying to steal the pot, but it's just not that hard to have a hand much better than yours. Also, you have a bad kicker. You know, like flush draws are good hands. Somebody could easily have checked an ace. Your hand is bad. It's a multi-way pot. This is just a great bread and butter illustration of the difference between heads up and multi-way pots. And not all second pairs are created equal. And also there's like a rake angle too.
More rake is coming out of this pot.
More rake's coming out of the pot, and like this may not look like an overbet, but it was an overbet on the flop. So you're calling an overbet with a hand that's behind a lot and can't really improve.
It's not even drawing that well. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a king's a pretty good catch for you. As we're about to see, like, it's entirely possible to catch a five and still start to question the strength of your hand.
Yeah. And like, even if you get lucky, like the best case outcome, or like the best reasonable case outcome, I think, is like you call and everybody else folds and the bettor has like Jack 10. And that's like good for you, but it's not even great. Like, he's got a lot of equity, and he might bluff you out. Like, it's just fold, just fold. But like, I'm saying this in a sort of terse way. But you know, it's an extremely common mistake. I've made it a lot of times in my poker career. You'll see this a lot. I'm not saying that Benito is a particularly bad player. I think calling is a standard play here for huge, huge, huge parts of the player base. A lot of people play this spot, you know, misplay this spot, who play many other spots correctly. So, with no condescension intended, this is an extremely clear fold, I think.
Agreed. Benito says there's $28 in the pot after he calls, so either more rake didn't come out or he didn't account for it. But $25 to $28 in the pot on the turn. We're heads up now, so the other limpers fold. And the turn is the Five of Hearts, giving our hero two pair. So the board is Ace of Spades, King of Hearts, Ten of Spades, Five of Hearts. Our hero has King of Diamonds, Five of Spades. He says, I'm thinking on this flop, the button is betting all of his aces, which are quite a few since he limped on the button. I don't think he's betting many two pair or broadways, as many players will slow play these on drier flops. He says no flush draw, but there is a flush draw on the board. So that's his sort of read on what's going on the flop, which I don't even think I agree with the part about the villain slow playing two pair of Broadway, but I mean, it is true he has many aces in his range, which is why we don't want to call the flop bet. Anyway, he says this to justify that he wants to bet the turn, basically. He says, by betting the turn, I get value from his aces that are behind and deny some equity as well. So the hero here ends up betting $30 into the $28 pot after turning two pair. And I understand what he's saying, and it may be true that the villain is going to check back a decent amount when he has an ace, But I think, I mean, I guess just a lot relies on Benito's assumption, which I don't agree with, that the villain is not going to bet if he has a two pair or a straight or something like that. Because kind of fundamentally, and this will make the most sense to people who have read my book, Play Optimal Poker, but hopefully it'll make sense even if you haven't. The villain here is really the player with the more polarized range. Like, our hero happens to have turned a pretty strong hand, but it's really quite unlikely that the five would improve the hero. Like, overall, the hero having just checked and called the flop and then seeing a five on the turn, the hero's range should consist almost entirely of medium strength hands. And arguably, King Five is still a medium strength hand. It's just one of the better medium strength hands, but I'm still not at all sure it's a hand we really want to play for stacks in a limped pot. So I think what should be happening here is the hero is really the player with the condensed range. The hero should just be checking his entire range in the spot. And then the player on the button is the player with the more polarized range, who should be betting, you know, strong hands for value, and in theory also betting some bluffs, although honestly I question how many bluffs he even has in his range after betting the flop. So I think that essentially the hero here should still be deferring to the button, even in the rare case where the hero actually has a pretty strong hand. So much of the hero's range is going to consist of hands that want to check in this spot, that there's really not a need for the hero to do the betting. Like, I think the right amount of the amount of money that the hero wants to put into the pot when he has King Five, or should want to put in the pot when he has King Five, is going to go into the pot as a result of hero checking. Like, we check call again on the turn, or if the turn goes check check, then we just make a big value bet on the river. Like, I think that's about the amount of money that we want to put into the pot with this hand, and we're going to accomplish that by checking the turn. By betting the turn, especially betting really big like this, I think we're making it pretty easy for the villain to fold many of his second best hands. Like, I actually think this should be a pretty easy fold for the villain with an ace, although I guess some people won't make that fold. But we're also setting ourselves up to play probably a pot that our hand is not quite strong enough to warrant.
Yep. I mean, do we want to bet a lot here? I think the answer is no.
Here, meaning with our range.
Yes. In our range, like, Andrew said this better, but I just want to emphasize that range against range, this is not really a betting spot, I don't think. Certainly not often. I'm very happy to check this hand. And that's that. But, you know, I'm not saying this is an atrocious bet. Like, you will be ahead a fair amount of the time. Betting has its benefits. I think it's a pretty clear check, but, you know, there's some reasonable thinking behind this, and it will have some benefits that checking does not have. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the equilibrium play is a check. Benito does, it's more, I guess it's more that I just am doubtful about some of Benito's assumptions. I think his assumptions of, like, villain will not fold an ace, villain will often check behind an ace, villain will rarely have better than an ace. If all those things are true, betting probably is a good exploitative play. I just think that's, like, it's a pretty big parlay, and betting is going to be a mistake pretty quickly if, like, as those assumptions start falling apart.
Yeah,
and I don't have a lot of confidence in those assumptions.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's a good way to say it, I think. And at least, like, when I've had students who have said things like that, it's been pretty clear that they just don't want it to go check check and then get counterfeited on the river,
right? Yeah.
so that's that. Like, I have no way of knowing whether any part of that is in Benito's mind, but I think it's a pretty clear check. I'm just saying, yeah, it's a play that there are some plays that I wouldn't make that I think are, like, strictly worse than the alternatives, and this is something where I think checking is better, and from a range perspective, checking is better, but in a vacuum, I don't think it's very bad, and it does give you some real benefits. Mm-hmm. So, I respect the thinking behind this play.
Okay, so now some rake must have come out of the pot, because the button calls and the river, there's $85 in the pot, Benito says, and the river is the four of hearts. So the backdoor heart draw gets there. Final board is ace of spades, king of hearts, ten of spades, five of hearts, four of hearts. Our hero has king five with the five of spades. Now $85 in the pot, and hero bets 120. He says, "I've been playing with this bet sizing on rivers that I can be very polar on." it's true that in situations where you can be very polar, especially on rivers, that overbetting is good. I do not think this is one of those situations.
You're kind of like smack dab in the middle, like right here. Yeah, it's a.
So for one thing, what are your bluffs in this spot? What are the hands that you check call and overbet on the flop with, and then lead for pot on the turn and are bluffing? So I think like one of the problems here, like one of the things that really constrains or determines your ability to bet large with the strongest hands in your range, is the possibility that you might be bluffing. That's what gives your opponent the incentive to call a bet with, say, just a bear ace on the river, which is what you need to get called by. Or if you're betting a bad two pair, you need to get called by like the best one pair hands, or that's like your value target. So, you know, like, why would the villain call this bet with an ace? He would have to think that the hero is bluffing, and bluffing a pretty decent amount of the time, considering that we're looking at an overbet. So, you know, I think it's pretty difficult for the villain, if the villain is doing any kind of, you know, attempting hand reading at all, he's got to be able to think that the hero has a fair number of bluffs before it makes sense for him to start calling with just an ace. And I think pretty much any other hand that he might call with other than an ace is going to have the hero beat. You know, I would be quite surprised if we saw him calling with just like Jack 10 or something. Now, if the villain is just some sort of very calling stationy, like never going to fold top pair, not even trying to hand read, again, like I guess this could be good for exploitative reasons, but I wouldn't be talking of it in terms of like being polar here. I mean, I against the sort of player who's going to call this bet with any ace, like you wouldn't want to be bluffing ever in this spot. So I think like the instinct is right that you do want to be overbetting in situations where you can be very polar. I just don't agree that this is that case. I mean, not only is it hard for us to have bluffs, we also don't really have any of the nutty hands on this board. And like, I think it's much easier for the button, the player who bet the flop, to have a hand like Queen Jack, or I mean, you don't really see people limping behind like tens too often in his shoes, but I think it's at least more plausible that the button limped tens than that our hero checked tens in the big blind or didn't check raise tens on the flop. I mean, I think that the hero, by checking his option pre-flop and also by checking and calling the flop, has done a lot more to take the very strongest hands out of his range than the button has done. So I think that hero is both less likely to have bluffs and also less likely to have really nutty hands than the villain. And that's a reason why the hero should be checking rather than the reason why the hero should be overbetting. So Benito is right that the player with the more polarized range should be doing some river overbetting. I just think in this case, that's not Benito.
Yep, that's a great sort of range against range analysis. I also just want to emphasize that I think players sometimes just overvalue two pair here, especially because the limp behind preflop from the button means he probably doesn't have ace queen or ace jack.
Yeah.
Like, what's the value target here? Like, I think Benito's maybe more likely to fold out a better hand than you get called by a worse one here. You know, full credit for considering an overbet. A lot of players don't. Full credit for thinking about what a polarized range is. A lot of players don't. You know, and you even see some players make a junky two pair and then sort of get embarrassed of it in some sense and not want to put a lot of money in the pot with it. You know, I don't think that's what's going on here. So there are definitely some elements that are going right here. But once you get called on the turn after the flop overbet, I think you have a bluff catcher. So I would check and evaluate. I think check folding is not real bad to a big bet. I think check calling a small bet is good. So that's my play.
Yeah, you know, I should say when I first started trying to implement overbetting into my game, like I was doing it in all kind of wrong spots. So this is definitely not me like looking down on anybody. I think this is
confirmed. This
is like part of how you get better. And I think like a willingness to do things that are new to you, like knowing that you're going to make mistakes with them sometimes, is I think essential to getting better. Like if you just sort of stay in your comfort zone and only do what you've been doing, I mean, A, you're going to make mistakes anyway because some of what you've been doing is wrong. So you're not even avoiding mistakes by just sticking to what's familiar. But I think ultimately you have to be willing to make mistakes in the course of trying to do new things and, you know, trust that ultimately as you learn to do those things well, it's going to be like long-term plus EV that you've learned to implement those things.
Yep.
Results. Villain tanks and tanks and tanks and play with his cards. Looks like he's really agonizing and finally shoves for his remaining $270. So it's only $150 more to our hero. I think I'm still folding here.
So I'd still fold. Yeah. I mean, so exploitively fold. non-exploitively, what do you want to call with? Not this. Okay. And yeah, that's that. I mean, you'd want to block Broadway or block three aces or whatever. Yeah, yeah, not aces, but you know, you'd whatever. Yeah, I just don't think you win. The backdoor flush got there, and the ace is not a heart. So, like, there's ace X of hearts. I'd want to block that hand, I guess. Yeah, when Hero doesn't have a heart in his hand, but like, really, in this game, after this action, you've narrowed the ranges so much with all this overbetting, and now the other guy's shoving. Like, just next hand. It's
yeah. I mean, so it's tempting to think about this. Like, oh, it's not that much more. I bet 120, and he only shoved for 150 more. So, you know, ultimately, the pot is going to be 475, and it's 150 for Hero of the Call. So, if the villain is bluffing, you know, one time in four, this is going to be a profitable call for our hero. I don't think the villain is bluffing anywhere near one time in four. I also don't think he's ever shoving worse for value. I would expect to see a straight almost always in this spot.
He got to the river. Like, he doesn't have any bluffs going into the river. He'd have to be turning something into a bluff, which is unlikely to be happening. And even those hands, like, probably don't call the turn. And he doesn't bluff with them. And some of them got there.
Actually, I said straight. You know, there's also a backdoor flush that came in.
Yeah.
I really don't know what we could possibly beat by calling on them. I think this is, like, even if I were getting 10 to 1, I would fold. Like, this is...
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that might be a little exaggeration. But, like, you really don't beat... Like, it's very hard for the villain to show up with a bluff. He never has worse for value. Like, I don't know the pot odds are coming into it all that much in this case. It's just, like, you're just always beat here.
And, like, again, it's important to say we get a lot of spots where we say on the air... Well, if you fold here, then villain has a profitable bluff with his other hands. But here, again, there aren't any bluffs going into the river. The ranges have been narrowed so much by the betting. You're not leaving yourself open to exploitation if you fold this. You know, if somebody is turning all his one pairs into bluffs, like, I mean, A, he's not. And B, like, you have all these other hands. Like, your range should be very narrow. You called an overbet, then you made an overbet, and then you overbet again. You know, like, don't worry. You can be the sheriff plenty in this spot, just not with King Five.
Yep.
But, you know, then you got curious and you wrote to podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and that's a great play every time.
Thank you, Benito. Hopefully we weren't too hard on you. I think that'll be at least a good learning experience. As I said, I think there's a lot of concepts here that you understand the concepts, and it's just a question of when to apply them. So hopefully we've given you some good guidance.
Yeah. Did Benito send results?
I'm assuming he folded. But
yeah, good fold. I'm assuming you folded.
Yeah, that's true. Nice play. Yes. And that takes discipline, because I know, and it also requires, like, clearly it required him, even though we were thinking about the hand differently than he was, to make a fold here requires you to dramatically change in-game how you're thinking about your hand. I have the nuts,
yeah.
Which I don't really agree with, but clearly that's what he was thinking, turn and river. He was like, I've got the nuts.
Yeah.
And then to 360 from that and go, oh, crap, actually,
I
have to fold.
I have to fold the nuts getting, you know, a lot to one. Like, that's pretty good, you know? It's just like 30 more red chips in this pot. That's like much, much more than 30 red chips. So,
yeah
that's a good fold, good awareness, and... good luck to you.
Okay, next hand coming to us from John says, I played a hand at the weekend where I felt that I probably went wrong on every street, as most options were possible, at least at first sight, so I thought I'd share it with you. The theme is how to play a draw against an aggressive opponent. I was playing 1 pound, 1 pound, 8-handed, live at Dusk Till Dawn in Nottingham, England. I'm under the gun with Jack 10 of hearts. Big Blind is a young Latvian guy who I've played with a couple of times. He's fun to sit next to, plays a lot of hands, likes to run a big bluff. We're 200 pounds deep. I open to 3 pounds, cutoff, button, and Big Blind is the main villain here, call. Cutoff and button are old, loose, and straightforward, as opposed to me, who is old, tight, and straightforward. So our hero opens under the gun to 3 with Jack 10 of hearts, gets called by cutoff button and big blind. So before rake, there's 13 pounds in the pot. And the flop is king of clubs, queen of spades, 2 of diamonds. So our hero has an open-ended straight draw, but no backdoor flush draw.
This podcast needs more British humor. I really appreciated that infusion of British humor into the show. If you're British, please write in.
So what do you want to do here? A big blind checks to the hero. I think we can... Well, yeah, I mean, what do you see betting, check raising?
So we are, again, we flopped an open-ended straight draw. We raised under the gun with Jack-10 suited, which is good. I would continue. The flop came King-Queen-Deuce. I think there's a lot here we can represent. There shouldn't be too many draws in our range. I would like it even better if we had a backdoor flush draw, but like, you know, bad beat, you know.
I would like it even better if we had quads, I mean.
yeah. But like, you know, we have a really good hand, the rainbow board, you know, we've got 8 clean outs to the nuts, and we have like extremely good flexibility and bluffability later. There will just be a lot of good spots.
And we're pretty deep here. You know, because we started 200 big blinds deep, even with a raise and 3 calls, we're still looking at a stack to pot ratio that's well over 10.
And that's the thing. Like, so if we were short stacked, it would be more of a pot odds problem. And we just got done talking about how in multi-way pots, basically you just play honestly. Or, you know, like there's a lot of honesty in multi-way pots. But here, you can represent the nuts, which is really important. So, you know, again, multi-way pots are about, you know, who flopped a good hand, but a clean draw to the nuts is a good hand and represents the hands that are going to be good hands later. So that's really good. And it also means that you can put a lot of pressure on their top pairs and second pairs if they make, you know, if he calls with them. You're going to be in a great position later. And it's deep enough to where these things are all really going to come into play. So it's not just, am I getting the right price? Do I get lucky and fold everybody out sometimes? Like, this is a four-handed pot where there's going to be some playability left, and you flop the best draw there is on the board. So, I would bet with an eye to remembering that you have a lot of kings and queens and you know, overpairs in your range relative to your opponents. And this isn't just a draw. This is a draw to a good bluff spot too. So
Yes, I mean, speaking of like polarized and condensed ranges, I mean, a good rule of thumb is don't do a lot of bluffing in four-way pots. Like, it's definitely not just because you're the pre-flop raiser, you should bet every flop. I mean, even a heads up, that's not true. It's certainly not true four-way. My experience has actually been that people probably underbluff a little bit in four-way pots. Like, they take that rule a bit too far of like never bluff in four-way pots. The real rule is like you should be very selective about your bluffing in four-way pots. But this is a very advantageous flop. The combination of stack depth plus this exact flop texture, where like, so having the nuts advantage matters. The deeper you are, the more it matters that you have the uncapped range. So on this board, you know, probably you are by far the player most likely to have pocket kings, pocket queens, pocket aces, ace king. So 4 of the 6 strongest possible hands, or, you know, assuming people aren't playing king deuce and queen deuce, like 4 of the 6 strongest possible hands on this board, including the 2 very strongest, are in your range and, you know, rarely if ever in your opponent's ranges. And the implication of that is that, as you said, Nate, you can put a, like, your opponents will very often have a king or a queen. Like, that's quite likely that in a four-way pot someone has one pair. However, it's not going to be trivial for those players to put large amounts of money in the pot with those hands. Like, if you know, you're not going to get them to fold it to one bet. Like, if you just, you know, you shouldn't expect that someone's folding a pair of queens when you bet $8 and $13 on the flop, £8 into £13 on the flop. But it is going to be plausible that by betting on multiple streets, you're going to eventually put enough pressure on those hands to fold. And when you're choosing which hand do I want to make those bluffs with, having a draw to the nuts is exactly what you want. And when you're this deep, it's much better to have a draw to the nuts than it is to have a draw to a considerably weaker hand, which on this board isn't really the case. But if we imagine like a 10-9 deuce flop, Jack Queen is a much better bluffing hand than 8-7 on 10-9 deuce when you're deep. Because even though they're both open-ended straight draws, and like even making the low end of a straight is still relatively good, it's a lot better to make the high end. And then, you know, if there's a flush draw draw on the board, like the flush draw is going to be a better bluffing hand than the straight draw, or the straight draw is going to be a better bluffing hand if you also have a flush card in your hand. Like, the deeper you are, the more you want to be thinking about your potential to make hands that you can at least treat as the nuts if they get there, even if they're not going to be the literal nuts. And so, like, that's more true of the higher straight draw than the lower straight draw. But on this board, you basically do have the higher straight draw.
Yeah, and your range advantage is so strong that you can even add some more bluffing hands to this. Like, this is a primo bluffing hand. Right. I think if you put ace-jack or ace-10 suited into my range where I have a backdoor flush draw,
yep.
I think I would bet those pretty much every time. I'd like to say I bet them sometimes and check them sometimes, but I don't really see myself checking those a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, you're, even though it's four-handed, like,
100-0 is a mix.
Yeah, you know, it's sometimes I'm ordering a drink. It's just such a good spot. You can even, you know, get a little spicy and, put some extra hands in there. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to say about this situation is that when you get raised, like, yeah, somebody sometimes flop king queen or three deuces, but especially at like 1-1, you're gonna get people making feeler raises, and like, this is a really nice bet three betting hand against the raising ranges that you will see in this spot at 1-1 tables. And by that I mean raising ranges that fold the three bets a lot. And yeah, so that's that. But mostly, you know, you have a really good hand, bet 8 into 13 is fine. I'd probably go a little bigger. It's fine.
Yeah, I think this is a spot where you are going to be pretty polarized as early as the flop when you're betting. Like, yeah. I don't think you should ever really be betting a queen here. Maybe ace-queen, even that I wouldn't really advise. Like, you shouldn't be betting pocket jacks. You shouldn't be betting queen-jack. Like, when you bet here, you should either have a bluff or you should have a quite strong made hand that's happy to put a lot of money into the pot. So you can be more polarized, which means larger bet size. 8 into 13 is, for a flop bet, is still... Like, I'd say it's like the low end of the large bucket, but yeah, I would happily bet 10 or even 12 in this spot.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, John does bet 8 into 13. The cutoff and the button fold, and it comes around to the Latvian, who, if you remember, John described as he's fun to sit next to, plays a lot of hands, likes to run a big bluff. And Latvian check raises to 24 pounds. John says he's perfectly capable of doing this with complete air, and that's probably what he mostly has. With a medium strength hand, I would simply look to calm down. With a straight draw, I could re-raise, but I'm not happy if he raises me again. Or maybe I should just jam? Possible, I suppose. I decide to call and see the turn.
So I just got done saying that I would want a 3-bet raise. Given exactly that he has a full stack, I think John is extremely right that stacks are awkward for semi-bluff 3-betting here. However, I think I probably still would for a couple reasons. Especially if, as described, this person can over-bluff. A lot of these people sometimes find bad reasons to raise with other hands. Like, and he's in the big blind. Like, I think you're going to see some kings here sometimes, like king 10. I do think those hands that are going to fold to a 3-bet are pretty well represented in this person's range. And if he has complete air, like, you have jack high, and winning by 3-betting is a fantastic result. So I'd probably 3-bet to a size that, like, discourages a shove, like, looking to shove the turn. 24, like, should make it like 63 or something like that. And then he calls, and then you can shove the turn a lot. I think that's pretty sweet, and you get a lot of folds. That could be a very exploitable thing to do, but against the range and the player described, and given how strong your range is, like, I think he can't just blast off against you. So I agree, it's bad if you get 4-bet. So A, I would look to discourage it, but B, I would realistically assess how likely it actually is to get 4-bet, and I would answer not very likely.
Yeah, there's a lot that I want to say here. So I'm taking John at his word that this fire could easily have air. I would say he should not easily have air.
No, it's a really bad spot.
This is not a good spot for him to just check raise with any two. Like, he has to worry about, like I just mentioned, like all those strong hands that are in your range are in your range. And you should not be, I mean, so his bluff is going to get a lot better if you are over c-betting this spot. I kind of doubt that John is, based on what I know about John, but... I think so. Like, if I mean, we're already going down an exploitative road if we're assuming that he's like actually mostly has air, which is what John says. So if I take John literally that this player mostly has air, the question I would ask myself is, what's the most plus EV thing I can do against his air? And I agree, there's a lot of interest in three betting. There is the awkwardness of if you get four bet. I mean, it should be pretty hard for him to four bet jam on you. Like, what? I mean, I would just ask, like, what hands can he four bet jam on you? Pocket twos for sure, king queen for sure. I'm out of options now. Like, yep. Maybe another combination of jack 10.
Yep.
But like, it's very hard. Like, once you three bet, like kings and queens should loom very large in your range. Like, it should be pretty scary for him to just like rip it into your three bet. So I mean, this kind of just becomes a question of like, if you believe you have a pretty strong read that this player really likes the bluff a lot, you know, do you believe he's gonna make a four bet shot? Like, I can't answer that. I mean, he shouldn't. I can tell you that, but he also shouldn't be check raising with a lot of air in the first place. So, you know, once we're going down a road of exploitation, it's a question of what you want to assume. I think a good rule of thumb when you have a strong draw like this, excuse me, John's instinct is absolutely right that you want to play your strong draws aggressively. You want to be looking for opportunities to play them aggressively. As you say, Nate, you have jack high. Like, even the villain's bluffs are going to have decent equity against you. You don't really want to let them realize that equity. That said, it's also true that when you have a really premium draw, you'd like to avoid ending up in a spot where you could get pushed off of that equity, which is the risk that you take by three betting. So this is actually one of the very first poker articles I ever wrote over 10 years ago for 2+2 magazine, was called The Last Bet. And the idea is just, you know, you want to think about, how can I structure the betting such that I'm the player going all in? If I have a strong draw, I want the fold equity. I also want to avoid getting pushed off the hand myself. So I want to be the player going all in. You could just rip it over his flop check raise. I don't think that's terrible. I think you're probably right, Nate, that a smaller three bet is certainly more consistent with how we're going to play other hands in our range. I mean, if the villain actually is bluff heavy, there's probably nothing he could do to make it. Like, what's he going to do? He's going to call you with ace jack? Like, I mean,
that would... Please do, yeah. Then fold on turn when I bet. Great.
Well, no, I mean, if we just shove. Like, if Hira just shoved for 200... You know, even if the villain is sort of suspicious that this is always jack 10, like, it's a pretty tough thing for him to exploit, unless, yeah. I guess, if he's check raising a lot of just like king 5 kind of hands, then, you know, he can hero off with those. But even then, like, our equity against is not that bad.
And like, what's he actually going to think? What he's actually going to think is that you have aces and want to end the pot. Like, that's, yeah. And he will not call with five. Yeah, no.
I think there's an even more appealing option, though, which is, and this again comes down to like, what do you think he's going to do with his air? But I think another very appealing option is to call the flop and then shove over a turn bet.
Yeah, that's good.
And that's going to set up, like, it's not going to be such a big over bet to shove. It's probably more consistent with how you would actually want to play your very strongest hands. So I would pretty seriously consider that. But I think a good rule of thumb when you have a really premium draw that is good enough to get all in, but you want fold equity, is to think about, you know, what betting line would result in me making the final bet, the bet that is all in. And in this case, I think it's peeling and then shoving over a turn bet.
Yeah, that's good. John does call. And yep. The turn is a king. Badoogie.
Yeah. So. Not the turn card we're hoping for.
No, the very worst turn card in the deck, in fact.
So John says I check, but I think the big blind... Unless he has positions wrong, probably the big blind stacks first. Big blind bets 35 pounds into a 61 pound pot. John says, now I have all the same problems that I had on the previous street.
No. Now you have much worse problems, which is that all those kings now, like, don't want to fold. Like, that's your real problem. And it's a lot worse than the problem. Like, you didn't have problems on the previous street. Previous street, your life was amazing. Like, it's like, you should be wistfully longing for your situation on the flop. Not, now this kind of sucks.
FML, I have 8 outs. You hope you have 8 outs. There's a chance you're drawing dead. I have 8 outs, and a quick calculation suggested at the time that I might have the implied odds to call this not very big bet, so I did. How I square that with my read that his range has lots of error in it, I don't know. Poker is much easier when you don't have a lot of people staring at you. More of your British humor.
This is a great email. I really like this email.
So I still don't think shoving is terrible. We still want the folds from whatever he's bluffing with. Like, he could even be bluffing with a hand that's better than yours. Like, he could have pocket fives here. You know, he could have, you know, at the very least, his bluffs probably have 6 outs against you to improve. So, I mean, I think you're going to have to play this hand aggressively at some point. Like, even if you call and he checks the river, you're going to have to bluff the river. Like, you're going to have to put a bet into the pot at some point. Wouldn't absolutely have to be a turn shove. I mean, turn shove is probably a lot less consistent now with how you play your strongest hands. You know, if you have, I wouldn't want to shove with aces for different reasons, but like if I had king, queen or pocket queens or something, I would just call the turn bet now because we have a full house. So I do think this is like, given my plan in general is to shove over a turn bet, this is a turn card I'm a good deal less excited about shoving on. I think probably the play is just to call and then bluff if he checks river. And I mean, if he fires a third time, I don't think I want to jam over his river. I think we just accept that if we miss on the river and he fires a third barrel with his bluff, I think we just accept that we lose the pot. And it was just kind of a combination of an unfortunate run out and a very stubborn villain, and stubborn in the sense of like stubbornly making a play that's very negative EV for him and is going to happen to work out well against this exact part of your inch.
Yep.
So John does. I mean, I wouldn't fold. Let's start there. I would not fold. I think against a player who's going to be overly bluff heavy, we still have way too much equity to fold. Yeah.
And like, also, what would you do with ace king? Probably bet the flop. Probably call a raise. Probably call this bet on the turn.
Right.
Maybe raise, but probably call. Like, it's good things can happen. I'd call.
Yeah. So our hero calls, and we go to the river with 131 pounds in the pot, and the river is the 10 of clubs. So final board is king, queen, deuce, king, 10. I don't think the backdoor flush draw came in, but let me know. No flush draw or anything. King, queen, deuce, king, 10 is the final board. Our hero holding jack 10. Villain bets 50 into 131. John says, I have about 120 behind. Fold, call, or raise? Fuckity, fuckity, fuck. Clear call given my read?
I mean, if he really is going to fire a lot with pure air, then I guess you have to call. Probably most people are not actually like that, or cannot be known to be like that. Yeah, it's a pretty small shove, like, especially now that you block King 10. Yeah.
It's not a shove, it's just a bet.
Yeah. Oh, I'm talking about shoving over the bet. Okay. It's actually bad. I would probably just fold at this point, given that he can't really fold a king, given the odds he's getting if you shove, and this looks a lot like a king. If you were deeper, I'd be very tempted to try to make him fold King 7, but I don't think you can fold King 7. I would do what I would do if I knew that the other guy had King 7, and in this case, it's fold.
Yeah, I mean, is he over bluffing in this spot? Only you know the answer to that. If you think he is, then yeah, it's a call. Like, you have you have a pure bluff catcher in a spot where I think it's pretty suicidal for the villain to be bluffing. You're supposed to have some hands. The theory is you should have some hands that call the turn and fold the river. And I don't know what that would be if not this hand. Like, most of your turn calling range should be stronger than this. You should have full houses. You should have trips. You should have queen X. Well, not really queen X, they bet the flop, I guess. But you should just have a lot of, like, your range is very strong for raising under the gun, c-betting into four people, calling a check raise on the flop, calling a turn bet. You are definitely at the stone bottom of your range here, and the fact that you can beat a bluff is only relevant if the villain is over bluffing in this spot. If your read is that he is over bluffing in this spot, then yeah, it's a call. But I mean, it requires the villain making a pretty big mistake before. Like, this is, I think this is more than close at equilibrium. Like, I think this is a clear fold at equilibrium. So you would just need like a very strong read that the villain is over bluffing before calling could become correct here. But you know, if you have that read, then calling is correct.
Well said.
We do have results from John, and it's part of why I've been hedging so much on this. If you have a read that the villain is over bluffing business, because John does fold and the villain shows 5-4 offsuit. So the villain was in fact massively over bluffing.
I mean, easy for us to say, but we should say it anyway. Like, don't worry, given what your range actually is, you're going to make so much money in this spot over time, and probably a lot of money from this villain over time. But like, oops.
but do be careful about over-c-betting the flop. Like, the main thing that is constraining the villain's ability to just barrel off like this with 5-4 should be that your flop betting range is already pretty strong. If you're just trying to see, and I don't think John is doing this, but like, if you're just trying to c-bet anywhere near 100% in this spot, like, his line might actually, at least like the flop check raise is going to be profitable for him. I don't know about the barreling off part, but like, this becomes a lot less bad on the villain's part if you're making a range mistake on the flop. But if your flop play is reasonable, then this is just suicidal on the villain's part, and he got very lucky to run into one of the few hands in your range that's going to fold here.
Yep. Well, thank you to our correspondents. Thank you, as always, to our listeners. And thank you, Andrew. This has been fun recording with you.
Yeah, it's a rare treat for us to get to record in person, and especially since you weren't in Las Vegas this year. I'm glad we got a chance to do it here.
Yeah, fantastic. And we will talk to you all next week.
Devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't, you won't, you won't, you won't, will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't, will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't, you won't sign. I drafted up a beautiful contract.